some background. Give ourselves a little bit of context for those of you who may be familiar or less so with either the Chronicles of Narnia or C.S. Lewis himself. So this book represents the first book of a seven-book series. Pay no attention to where it says book number two.
That's
a dirty lie. So here's the deal about that. Here's the deal about that. C.S. Lewis writes this book first. He is inspired by a very interesting painting that has snowy woods and a fawn who is holding kind of an umbrella as the snow falls. And he sees that kind of evocative scene and he just wants to kind of explore that idea. And this book, written initially for children, I mean, you can see the dedication that it's written for his goddaughter. This is Lucy Barfield, daughter of his good friend Owen Barfield, who's one of the Inklings, one of the group of those guys who, basically they go to pubs and they talk about big topics and fascinating things. C.S. Lewis was a part of it. Owen Barfield was a part of it. J.R.R. Tolkien was a part of this group. And so they used to, you know, kind of test each other and compare notes and talk big thoughts and all this sorts of great stuff. And so he writes this story as a children's story. And he writes it, you know, primarily for Lucy, but, you know, in the sense of he always loved children's stories and fairy tales. And so this was his attempt at writing a children's story, a fairy tale. And it was inspired, again, by that picture that he had stumbled across with the fawn in the snowy woods. So, the introduction itself, or the dedication rather, I think is actually quite helpful in understanding his perspective. I wrote this story for you, but when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you are already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it is printed and bound, you will be older still. But someday, you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from some upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. I shall probably be too deaf to hear and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate daughter.
He is so fun.
So, and that's the thing, is that if we can put ourselves back in memory and in time to growing up, every generation, I think this is common too, it's just they think about it, about different subjects and different topics, but there's some kind of dividing line within childhood where you kind of feel a little too grown up for the stuff that you used to like. And there's almost a point of pride in saying, oh, I don't do that's for babies. I don't do that stuff anymore, or I don't read that stuff, or I'm not interested by that anymore. Now, there's all sorts of things that are like that, that when we're very young, and we feel no sense of kind of pressure or societal norms or trying to look cool or whatever it is, that we just kind of do. They've done this in some studies and sort of sociological things. Ask a child of six to draw a picture of a giraffe, and they won't even hesitate. Boom, they just go right to it. Ask a 13-year-old to draw a picture of a giraffe, and suddenly they're filled with consternation. And you know, then they want to maybe not draw because they don't want to embarrass themselves, or if they draw, they want you to very meticulous. They have to erase it and start over. They want you just right, just perfect. Small children dance at the drop of a hat. But you get a little older, you get a little more self-conscious, and suddenly, And what C.S. Lewis writes in his dedication there, I think, is very clearly connected to that. Fairy tales we think of as telling them to very small children. But then there comes a point, and if you've had this experience with your own children, perhaps, But if not, then maybe you can recall in your own self where there came a time where whatever sort of stories or whatever sort of music or whatever sort of game or activity that you used to enjoy just easily and naturally, there comes a point in growing up and you're like, no, not anymore. I've outgrown that. Well, like art or dancing or any number of things, it's really our lack of maturity, not our maturity, that tries to set these things aside. And fairy tales can have a deep resonance and kind of a special delight as we get old enough, finally, to not be embarrassed by liking them.
That's true.
I'll liken this to something in a little more, this is a little sideways, and it's very personal, but I think maybe this is still connected. I remember going to my 10th high school reunion, thinking, oh, you know, this is going to be kind of cool and interesting, and we'll see, you know, how people change or whatever. And I found it to be pretty cliquish. You know, that people were still kind of in that high school mentality of which group you were in, and who were your friends and who weren't your friends, and there was just a little bit of an awkwardness that I was kind of frustrated by. I was disappointed that after 10 years, there's some things that were still kind of twitchy about it. And I went back to 20, and it was much easier going. And suddenly, and it was in a much more casual environment, but suddenly people were just kind of hanging out.
Wait till you get to the 50th.
And I've heard that with each successive one, partly because, you know, there's fewer people to reunion with, it kind of doesn't matter.
That's right.
You share something precious by having had this experience however long ago, and it doesn't matter if I had no idea who you were at the time. As of here and now, this is great. And let's talk, and let's, you know, reconnect and all that sort of good stuff.
At the 50th, I found out some guy had kept track of where I was until I moved.
Really? I knew him in school,
but he never, you know.
My mom actually hosted her 50th at her house over at the beginning of the summer. And, you know, there were some people that she knew and a couple that she didn't. No. It's been 50 years. And it was, you know, a big high school class. But they had a bunch of people gather at her house. But everybody had a blast. And, you know, as you genuinely mature, I think maybe you can start being reopened to things that when you were small and almost like you didn't know better, you didn't know you were supposed to be embarrassed, you didn't know you weren't supposed to talk to so-and-so because they weren't cool or whatever, that you can just start being a little more open and honest and straightforward and real. And so fairy tales are one of those things that you can revisit. The great adventure stories, you know, think about the ones that have stood the test of time, King Arthur and Robin Hood, or even think of, you know, stories like, I could think of being a kid and still seeing stuff around about Heidi or Pippi Longstocking. And they survive generation after generation because there is something almost transcendent about the story, about the theme, about the characters, about something. And even when people grow out of it, if they will allow themselves, they will grow right back into it. Because it's not childish, but it could be childlike. And that distinction, I think, is a good one.
Doesn't say Jesus tells us to act like children.
Like childlike. Not childish. You know, self-centered and petty and uncritically thinking and all that kind of stuff. But more childlike. So when we hear childlike rather than childish, how can we distinguish that? What might you suggest as a distinction?
The uninhibited.
I mean, like a good uninhibited, not like everybody took your clothes off uninhibited, but like a, you know, I don't have to put on a facade uninhibited.
Yeah, right.
What else?
Joyous.
Joyous.
And free.
Carefree.
I think especially about when we talk about the fatherhood of God and approaching Him like children, I think of that implicit sense of trust that small children have for their parents.
Oh, yeah.
Before parents are old and dumb and uncool and don't know anything good, we have hung the moon and the stars for our kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that age, there's like everything that we say is just like, well, duh, you know, daddy was going to take care of me. I remember going on these, we didn't do many of them, but you know, we would like a big vacation trip, like a, you know, get in the car and drive, almost cross country sort of stuff. And when I was small, and I never worried once, where are we going to stay? Do we have enough money? Are we going to run out of gas? What's going to be like when we get there? I want to know. Are we there yet? But I never fretted about the logistics. Because my dad's got this. I don't have to worry about it. Well, now I'm the dad who's got it. And I have to worry about the logistics and the gas and we have enough money and everything else. But in essence, I want my kids to receive that gift of, you don't have to worry about this. Let dad take care of this. You just enjoy this. And I think that's the childlike wonder and trust and openness. And it's not being foolish. That's the childish, I think, element. And we've all met adults and grown-ups who are childish.
Oh, yeah.
But finding one who is childlike, I think, is more rare and more precious when we actually find it. So, C.S. Lewis, quite possibly one of the finest minds ever produced through England and Great Britain. He was a world-class scholar in English language, literature, and poetry. And growing up, was deeply wounded at the early death of his mother, who, despite his prayers, her sickness was not alleviated, and she died.
And how old was he?
I want to say he was like, 10. Was he 10? He was young. He was like, you know, this is he's old enough to understand, but young enough where this is a huge issue, and I mean, this is a life-changing event.
Did he have a happy childhood other than that?
He describes it as being, you know, ordinary, relatively ordinary. He and his brother and his parents, but after the death of his mother, he finds this distance between he and his father, a father who maybe just kind of doesn't know what to do as a single parent with these young boys. And so he and his brother kind of retreat with each other. And one of the things that they will do, super imaginative, and he's remarkably bright even at a young age, but they will invent these ongoing stories and games. And one of them he calls Animal Land, where it's a country populated by nothing but anthropomorphic animals. But it's not sort of a fantasy story like Narnia. It's a little closer probably to Frog and Toad, or to Beatrix Potter. I mean, when he describes these stories, they actually sound super dull. Like, you know, they were bankers, and they went about their daily life and commerce. And it's like, oh, what kind of kid are you? But you know, they were. He called them dressed animal stories, which, you know, was basically saying a very animal-like animal, but they wore human clothes, and they took on human, you know, characteristics. And so anyway, but that was put away with childish things. Not revisited for quite some time. He served in World War I, like most of the men of his generation did, and saw true horrors. He, as a young man, or really as first a child, as a growing teenager, he kind of bounced around a couple of boarding schools, having some very, very bad experiences. If you can imagine the kind of the dark element of the English boarding school system, he understood that firsthand. Now, he was always brilliant, always smart, always capable, but was really suffering in that environment and was continually coming back home and really found refuge and solace with a tutor. He was eventually sent not away to a school, but sent away to a tutor, a retired old professor who would then train him one-on-one to be prepared for university studies. And this guy made this huge formative impression upon C.S. Lewis. He referred to him as the Great Knock. And he was this imposing, larger-than-life Scotsman who had that particular Scots Presbyterian way of raw, unalloyed, concrete logic, and who would continually press young Jack about statements that he would make that were foolhardy or not supported or not worth saying because they had no meaning. So for the Great Knock, knowledge was everything, facts were paramount, and it must be logically consistent. And he trained C.S. Lewis how to think and how to approach things. And this sort of logical framework that we'll see in his writings and in his Christian apologetics for the rest of his life. Now, the Great Knock was a committed atheist. But his laser-like focus and insistence on critical thinking and on logic made this enormous impression on young C.S. Lewis, who is also an atheist at this time, that his search for real and genuine truth and its logical consequences were then connected later in life, after the war, after his university studies, as he is encountering these other bright minds of the era, these other guys, you know, some of whom will become the Inklings, who will continue to meet, you know, all the time, discussing life and literature in the pub. And these young men, including the very devout Roman Catholic J.R.R. Tolkien, really confront him with the reality of Christ. And C.S. Lewis, being not only the brilliant mind, but shaped and honed by the Great Knock to be a thinker of great specific logic, tells his little conversion story there. And it's a neat story. We've read it a couple of times as we've done other C.S. Lewis works. But basically, he comes to a point of realization that he knows that God is God, and it terrifies him. He becomes a theist first, because he just can no longer logically deny the existence of God. Remember, the Great Knock has taught him too well. And once logic has dictated a conclusion, you have to accept it. And he was miserable for it, and he hated it.
Tell me again what theist is.
A theist is a believer in God.
Okay.
Could be in a very generic sense or in a very specific sense. But an atheist, a non-theist, says, there is no God, I know that for sure, there is no supernatural, whatever. And a theist says, there is a God, there is a supernatural, there is a something above and beyond us, whoever, whatever that might be. So he doesn't start off as a Christian, he starts off as a theist by saying, dang it, you got me. I can't deny it anymore. Logic compels me, but I'm miserable. And then with more prayer and soul-searching and thinking through and the blessings of others, he comes indeed to a saving knowledge of Christ. He becomes, in not just his academic pursuits, but in writing and in speaking, a very popular author and a very popular speaker. As a matter of fact, the very, very well-known collection of short essays, Mere Christianity, starts off as a radio program. He was asked by the government to, this is near the beginning of World War II, and things are going very, very poorly. And, England is demoralized. How can we possibly stand up against Germany when they're steamrolling everyone else? You know, the Dunkirk movie just came out over the summer, and that kind of captures in some way this sense of futility, that we are about to be wiped out. No one can possibly stand against these guys. And yet, through an almost miraculous circumstance, so many of those stranded men of the British Expeditionary Force are saved and brought back home. But they're brought back home with their tail between their legs. And they're brought back home with Germany completely ascendant. They own the continent. Their army is bigger and better. Their air force is bigger than better. And all that separates us from destroying you is a teeny tiny English channel. And they just knew that it was only a matter of time. And Winston Churchill could proclaim, you know, we're going to fight and we're never going to surrender. But it was scary. It was very scary. And so through that time, through the period of the London Blitz, and as they're bombing England rather than starting off with a land invasion, C.S. Lewis is called on to make these addresses to kind of, you know, for the morale of the people. And, you know, they, you know, you talk about what you want to talk about. You're very compelling. And he kind of lays out this very, very, very broad, very, very basic, very almost universal sense of Christianity, which used to be almost just sort of pro forma and understood in England, but throughout modernity, the modern age, people have been drifting further and further away. And he was trying to help us come back. So, and he has become very famous, and he's an extraordinarily well-regarded scholar. Again, he is a world-class scholar in English literature, language, and poetry, and he's become a famous speaker and an apologist for Christianity and all this kind of stuff. And one of the things he does is he writes, and he decides to write children's story. He decides to remember back in his youth stories that he loved, that he felt, in his own description, baptized his imagination. These fairy tales, these stories of chivalry and adventure, gods and goddesses and the pagan myths, and he loved the Norse mythology in particular, that they had opened up his heart. They had enchanted him so that by the time he was a grown man and encountered Christ, the true story of God intervening in the world through Jesus was now connecting to some of the major themes of these stories he had read as a child, that he longed and he hoped. Boy, wouldn't it be awesome if these stories were really true? And that had kind of made an impression on him. And then as a young man, and seeing the gospel finally come alive, that they are true. They are true in Jesus. The promises that these older myths and older stories and older fairy tales had whispered or hinted at were now found in their fullness within Jesus. So fairy tales help prepare him to not only understand the gospel, but to love the gospel. And I'll bring back one more point about fairy tales and their importance. There's a great essay, which I encourage people to look up and to read if you've never done that, by G.K. Chesterton. And Chesterton was also just dead at this time, so he's just reading his writings. But Chesterton, another famous English author, but himself a Roman Catholic and, you know, writing decades before C.S. Lewis, he writes this one essay called The Red Angel. It's not like a page long. Super cool. And in The Red Angel, he talks about fairy tales and how important they are. And he's kind of criticizing people who are criticizing fairy tales, because fairy tales are scary. And fairy tales are filled with witches and ogres and things that give children nightmares, and we shouldn't tell them anymore. We should tell children happy stories and nice stories. And all these, you know, like the grim fairy tales and, you know, Hansel and Gretel pushing a witch into an oven. Don't tell them. That's just creepy and awful and wrong. You're going to either corrupt them or you're going to terrify them. And there's a real movement at the time, and it's not, frankly, that dissimilar from now, where things that we have done since time immemorial. Now, how could you possibly let children get exposed to this? How could you let a child ride their bike alone to school? Are you a madman? Do you want them to die? I mean, man, I'm not that old. I rode my bike every day. My parents had already left for work, and I would leave by myself to go. But little things we totally took for granted, and now like, oh, think of the children. So anyway, G.K. Chesterton writes this, and he says basically that fairy tales are scary, but that's the point. A child does not need a story, does not need a fairy tale or the Grimm brothers or whatever to be afraid of things that go bump in the night. They get to do that all on their own. There are real terrors in this world, and kids are attuned to that. They understand and they know. The reason the fairy tales are so critical is not because of the scary element, but because within the telling of the fairy tale, for every dragon, there is a knight in shining armor to stand against it. For every witch, there's a Hansel and a Gretel to shove her in an oven. For every wolf, there is a Little Red Riding Hood to outsmart him. And he basically says that, you know, kids already have these fears and terrors because, let's be frank, as children or adults, there are real things out in this world to be afraid of. But what a fairy tale says is that God has armies too, and the darkness will not prevail. And so that element of the fairy story, of fairy tales, of these myths and stuff, it endures and it lasts. And when we think that we've grown up and grown out of them, we just need to grow up a little bit more, and we'll grow right back into them. And that's where we start. Okay, so that kind of set our ground a little bit for this. This is not coming from just anywhere. This is coming from somewhere where he writes this book. So, I asked you to do chapters 1 and 2, and I'm thinking that didn't take very long, right? I mean, it was like 20-something pages, and they're small pages, and it's childlike, not childish. And it reads very simply, and he's got kind of a tone about him that I think the dedication is just right. He's kind of like the godfather with the small child telling him a story. You have that kind of tone to his voice. So, let's actually look in these two chapters and talk about them. So, where do we start off in the setting at the beginning of the book?
The Blitz.
This is a consequence of the London Blitz. So we're in World War II. We're still relatively in the beginning of World War II. Who's winning at this point?
Oh, the Germans.
The Germans are totally winning. And the English are just basically trying to hold on. And so far they are, but how long can we hold on? And so with the Germans dropping bombs day and night on the city of London, what's happening in the book to reflect that?
Children are being sent away from London to protect them.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So, you know, they're keeping, you know, shops open and factories and so on and so forth, but we've got to protect our kids. And so the thought is to send them away from the cities. Cities are targets. Why would you waste a bomb on a nothing in the countryside? So if we can get these kids out of here, at least they'll be safe. And anyone have any personal knowledge or seen a documentary or talked to someone who this happened to? I had a seminary professor who lived through the Blitz. He was a young boy and he lived through the Blitz. But anyone?
Well, I have a friend in Brandon from England. Now, I don't know, she remembers some of the bombing, but she doesn't talk too much about a Blitz. I don't know. But anyway, her parents died very young and she was sent to an uncle up north that she'd never met and had to live with him. Yeah.
Now, and maybe they will do this at the end of the class, but the movie that was made about this several years ago is actually very, very good. Terrifically done. And it captures a few of the things that are hard to see within the book, because the book isn't talking about them, but it helps you kind of get into that framework. And the movie actually starts in the Blitz, and their home is being bombed, and then they're being sent away. And you have these train stations with thousands and thousands of children who just have tickets around their neck and whatever belongings they can carry. And they're going who knows where to stay with who knows who, and with just the stuff that they have, not ever knowing if they'll come back, not ever knowing if they'll see their parents again, what if their parents are killed in a bomb. And they're being sent, some of them had families to go to, but a lot of them were just sent out. And you basically had volunteers say, we'll take kids. I can take this many kids. And my neighbor can take this many kids. And this town can take this many kids. And it was a remarkable moment in English. English life for kind of like the Dunkirk, where you had all of these boats. I mean, yachts and fishing boats and pleasure boats and personal watercraft, all going across the channel to save these soldiers. And it wasn't just these Navy ships. It was just like some guy with a boat. And that's kind of where we are with this. These are just some folks in the country. And they're receiving these children.
What doesn't ring true to me that these children don't seem like they're, you know, miss their father and their mother and what is it? There's no fear.
I'm almost done with the book, and there's no mention of the parents.
When you talk about them, they were told. There's excellent documentaries and books. They were told you can't cry. You know, it is your duty. They were told duty.
I think that's absolutely correct.
You know, when we talk about British upper lip, you know,
the stiff upper lip.
Yes. The kids were sent, no emotion, you had to go, this is it, and they were dutiful, and they went. There was no coddling.
This is what you have to do.
Right.
Now, a couple of things. Number one, this is not an adult novel filled with deep emotional nuance. Yeah. And so it's not really exploring, so remember, it's starting off as a children's book. And so you tend not to dwell on the, you know, that emotional fear, maybe, or anxiety, especially if it's a kid who understands this already. If he's writing this book to a young girl, she's been through this. She didn't need to be told that people felt that way. She totally gets it. But in line with that, the stiff upper lip and everything else, remember, this is a country that ingrained within the way children are raised is at the young age, you're sent off to boarding school.
That's what I was going to say. They really don't think of their parents like we think of them.
It's different. It's different. Really different. And even if the emotional connection is the same because that's universal, there is the experience, I think, and the expectations are different. You know, if you were sent away at 6 years old to live 9 months out of the year somewhere else, and that was just what happened, you too might have a moment of sniffles, but then you kind of go off and do what you have to do. All right, so this is our setting, and where do they wind up? At the house of an old professor.
That has a bunch of hair.
Old haired professor.
You think that he got that from the man that he left with?
Yeah.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll get to know him a little bit now and a little bit more later. But he was absolutely and positively modeled on the Great Knock.
Probably when you started that, that's what I thought.
But anyway, here is this old man with white, shaggy hair all over his face. But right from the get-go, all the kids, they kind of like it.
Yeah, when he was very
good. Sounds like a cool house that they're going to live in.
This is a big house.
Yeah.
Like a playhouse.
Right. Anyone ever been in a place like that, like just a huge old meandering wandering house.
Yes. Yeah.
I remember visiting some relatives being very small. And maybe the house wasn't that big, but I was small.
Well,
so it seemed really big.
They get smaller.
Just wandering through and, you know, playing hide and go seek, and I mean the sort of stuff where it seemed kind of weird and unfamiliar and almost like a maze, and it's just really cool. And so I get this, and I follow with some of this wonder, like, oh man, if I was that age and it was a big giant house that has suits of armor and unused rooms and there's woods and there's stuff outside, and man, we can do anything. And I could get, especially since I have family with me. If I was there all by myself, that's one thing, but I've got, you know, it's four of them together.
Yeah.
And they see lack of supervision, and they see opportunity for adventure.
Right.
And that's really all you need as a kid, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So what kind of interactions are we seeing so far? You get kind of the barest glimpse in the first few pages about the four different children. So Peter is the oldest, Susan is next, Edmund after that, and Lucy is the youngest. Are you starting to see any personality come through yet?
Edmund is just kind of upset.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to do what they
want to
do, or he wants to go
to... Yeah, he's already kind of the little
snot-nosed. Yeah,
right.
All right. Who else?
Susan tries to be like mother.
Susan already starts mothering. There's something about, let's be honest, older sisters.
Yeah. I can definitely pass with that.
You're older than I
am.
Peter seems to be,
what's the right word? Settled,
but yet maybe a little bit more mature.
I get some leadership out of Peter. It's not super directive, and it's not that he's being the father, but there's just almost
leadership, let's go.
And so very, we don't have a lot of depth yet, but we're starting to see that they're each of them are different. Right. Which, if you have more than one child, they're all different. Okay. And we're already starting to kind of see that there are some archetypes there, somewhat bossy older sister, somewhat snotty younger brother, that kind of thing, but kind of in their own way. So what happens? We have the four kids. They are in this brand new place.
They're supposed to go to bed.
But
they decided that they didn't. They weren't that
sleepy. You're going to go on adventure.
True.
So they go.
Lucy discovers the word.
Well, they remember that their plan was to explore outside.
Right.
And it was raining.
It was raining.
So they decided to do more exploring. And they're just having a little blast with it. Because it's super cool when you're little and they've got. I mean, this guy's got. Cool stuff. I mean, you can tell me suit of armor, I'm in. So a lot of these seem kind of dull. The rooms are just like spare bedrooms, and they talk about, well, here's a big, room with books and books and books.
Yeah, there was a room with money in it.
And so,
and then the mirror.
What happens with Lucy in the room with the wardrobe?
She starts to go by herself.
Yeah, everybody sees this room.
Everybody sees the warm and the wardrobe, but Lucy's the one who really
She's the only one who cares.
She really wants to go in there.
She loves furs.
She loves furs.
Right.
Fur coats. Right.
Right. They all look in, and Peter actually says, nope, nothing in here, and they all walk away except for Lucy.
Yeah.
And why does Lucy like it?
The fur.
Yeah, there's probably something in that wardrobe that's going to be fun.
Yeah.
And she loves fur, and so she opens up the door and starts going in.
And there's more than one row of fur.
Apparently so. It kind of keeps on going. Now this has become, through this very simple but very neat little description, a kind of archetypal... element of fantasy, this doorway to a different world. It's happened in other places, but this in all of literature is one of the clearest examples, and it's been, very influential from there on out. But this super ordinary object, a wardrobe, and when I was little, I had the roughest time figuring it out because I don't get wardrobe. I have a closet. I don't have a wardrobe.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So it took a long time for me to kind of understand what this was.
They didn't have closets then. I guess not. I
never experienced that. I mean, you just always had a closet. But
we grew up in an old home in upstate New York, and we had very tiny closets.
Yeah, right.
So you needed something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the concept of like a big standalone cabinet, I had a hard time with, but understanding. But you open this door of the ordinary, and it leads to something inexplicably extraordinary.
I found it interesting that she went through something very soft and pleasing, but then the next thing, she gets those scratchy branches hitting her and it gets cold.
Right.
So there's a whole different feeling.
And there's this kind of horizon of experience where she travels and she's amazed that she's traveling so far, and almost very subtly, things change.
Yeah.
It's not like you open a door and there's something totally different. It's almost, I don't know, like a tunnel, but it kind of subtly changes until it's completely different. Almost before you realize it, you've gone so far and you turn around. How did they get in these boots?
But she doesn't. It doesn't worry her as long as she can still see the doors.
She still sees the doors. She's a sensible. Why is she such a sensible girl?
Why is she such a sensible girl?
Because everyone knows you shouldn't close the door or lock yourself in. So she leaves it ajar because she's a sensible girl.
Right.
And she even kind of turns back and she can see it.
She can see it. As long as she can see it.
And she's all right. So as a little girl, and I'm guessing she's maybe 6-ish, 7-ish, somewhere around that age.
Yeah.
You know, if it might be laid out somewhere. But I want to say she's probably 6 or 7. Edmund is, you know, a year or two older. Susan, a year or two older than that. And then Peter, a year or two older than that. So if Peter is the oldest, he's still only maybe 11 or 12.
Yeah.
He's not really even a teenager yet. These kids are all basically still elementary age. Maybe upper elementary in Peter's case. But they're still quite young. So there's a special fearlessness in Lucy.
Mm-hmm. She's too young to be afraid.
But not all kids are like that.
With that many older, I had 5. With that many older ones, she's got something. She's got to have some gumption.
She's probably pretty durable to withstand all the others. I've got 5, and our youngest is definitely, I mean, she just came out tough and different. But I think of number 3, how fearless he was around water, differently than all the other kids. Something about that. I mean, it was dangerous, because I remember it vividly, of him walking to the edge of my parents' pool with this big smile, and just straight down. And he sank like a stone with this big dopey smile on his face. And I had to reach down and pull him out and save him. Totally fearless. And some kids are like that.
Save me.
So it happens.
I'm still afraid.
It happens. All right. So she realizes she is in a snowy wood. And then what happens?
She meets the fawn.
Now, there's a little architectural detail here. Anyone note what's so unusual about these snowy woods? What object is unexpected in the middle of a snowy wood?
A lamppost.
Why in the world would there be a lamppost?
Yeah.
I'd like to show the way.
But it's just this kind of beautiful, neat little amazing image. This is definitely a fantasy land, but it's one that's just it's just kind of neat and cool. So she meets a fawn, and so fawns are mythological creatures. Anyone know kind of which culture we tend to see fawns in? This is more Greek myth.
It's a Greek.
Greek and Roman, but the fawns and the satyrs. How can you tell the difference between a fawn and a satyr? Fawns, the goat half is on the bottom. And satyrs, the goat half is on the top. Satyrs are way creepier.
Yeah.
Fawns seem kind of cute in comparison. So anyway, he's not inventing the concept of a fawn. The fawns are around from, you know, Greek and Roman mythology. And he'll even make some mention when he actually starts talking to Lucy, and he will reference some elements of Greek and Roman mythology. So, what happens with this fawn? How does she meet him?
She sees sees the umbrella and that draws her attention. This, and it's when he drops it.
Yeah. He's walking around. He's going home with parcels and an umbrella and a little scarf and stuff. And he's just kind of going about his day. And they kind of, and you're dropping stuff and helping and all this kind of stuff. So now they've met, and once again, Lucy is surprisingly cool with this.
Oh, yeah.
And not running away in terror and goat-legged man. I mean, it probably helps that they're like the same size. And he's got to look kind of innocuous and just kind of sweet. The goat element seems very mild, but he just looks like a nice guy coming home from Christmas shopping. So
the furry's legs is nice and silky.
Yeah. So her response seems enchanted. Like, oh, this is so neat. What's his response?
Thinks that she's the daughter of Eve.
That
one day he would be either the son of Adam or the daughter of Eve.
Okay. So he asks if she's a daughter of Eve, and initially she has no idea what that means. And he has to clarify. And his clarification is to just simply ask what?
Are you human?
Yeah. Are you human? And she's like, well, duh, of course I am. And the Fawn is very surprised because he's never seen a human before. And really had no inkling he would ever see a human. What do you think is significant about his first question, asking her not are you a human, but are you a daughter of Eve?
I wonder about that. I don't know.
Well, the beginning of
but the witch has told you.
She's already born. But isn't it supposed to relate to the beginning of time?
Okay.
Good.
So this is Adam and Eve that's being referred to, sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. So already we're starting to fold something in about the biblical account. That a way that these residents of Narnia, where apparently there are no humans, the way they refer to humanity is being a son of Adam or a daughter of Eve. Interesting thought. All right, so she eventually says she gets the idea that she's asking about humanity, and she says, yes, of course. And what happens next?
He invites her home.
Okay. And his name is? Mr. Tumnus. And that even sounds like just a jolly little name. Mr. Tumnus. Mr. Tumnus. And so he invites her to tea, and
sardines.
I would have gone back to the wardrobe.
Sardines delicious. It's in English.
I would have left.
Biscuits.
I'm sure there's got to be a good American analog, like I've got fresh baked cookies or pizza out of the oven. But sardines and toast, I would have said, I'm going back to work. But anyway, he says is enticing and it's friendly. Mm-hmm. It's not, if you notice, it's just very innocuous. This is very neighborly. This is not, come here, kitty, and I've got some candy in my van by the river. This seems like a very neighborly thing, right? Like in another generation when we would actually kind of invite a new neighbor over or bring them fresh baked goods or something, but this seems very, very friendly.
It's a nice way he has, but with nobody wants in the back of his mind.
But we don't know that yet. So far this is just delightful and friendly.
Very sweet.
And so she goes into his home, which is in a cave. But rather than being like a dark, scary, dirty cave, how is this one?
It's very cozy.
Very cozy and very warm.
Comfortable chairs.
Yeah.
Like it was already set up.
And a mantle.
It frankly kind of reminds me of Tolkien's Hobbit Hole.
Yeah.
It's a cozy little warm thing. And I do love the description of the two chairs.
Nice.
Yeah. One for me, and one for a friend. that's adorable. Just adorable. All right, so before we get to the big reveal, anything about their conversation that was either of interest to you or stuck out? And they clearly hit it off. It talks about they just, you know, they were like old friends. And if you've ever met anybody like that you just totally hit it off with, then you know that it's just a sweet feeling. And it's very
comforting.
Very comforting, very enjoyable. And you can definitely kill a lot of time with someone who's exciting to be around.
And they did.
She was there for a while.
Well, they have a nice tea.
Nice little tea.
Right. They didn't talk either while they had tea. Yeah.
Because he says, when Lucy was tired of eating, then the fawn began.
Right. Right. Wonderful tales of life in the forest, midnight dances, nymphs, dryads, old Silenus, and even Bacchus. So we are getting back again to Roman and Greek myths, mostly Greek. Bacchus, who is the god of wine. Silenus, who is kind of he's kind of a companion of Bacchus, typically portrayed as a jolly drunken man continually falling off a donkey. And the naiads, nymphs, and dryads are basically forest spirits of different things. Spirits of trees, spirits within rivers and streams, but some sort of personified spiritual being that's connected to some element of the even the forest is alive in this enchanted world. That's what he's talking about. Or at least it used to be.
He mentions how it's always winter.
He mentions these wonderful stories seem like a long time ago for some reason.
And she mentions that it's summertime where she came from.
Ooh, and that sounds really great, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How does he respond to that?
Calls it a certain land.
Yeah, it's funny because she's, you know, where did you come from? Well, I came from the wardrobe in the spare room.
Yeah.
And how does he translate that in his head? The city of wardrobe. Yeah. Like Warsaw, wardrobe. And the land of spare room.
Yeah, spare
room.
where it's always summertime and wonderful.
Yeah.
He starts playing this flute. He's enchanted her with these wonderful stories.
He wants to cheer himself up.
And
he's lulling her to sleep.
Playing this flute, it just makes her feel all these wonderful emotions, and eventually she starts to nod off. And what happens?
She wakes up.
When she's about, and you've probably done that at some point where, you know, you're just kind of like, and then something happens where you're just about totally down, and it just startles you enough to wake you up. And that seems to be what happens here. She, oh my gosh, look at the time.
Yeah, I've got to go.
And what's his response?
He doesn't want her to go.
He doesn't want her to go.
Because the wretched.
He starts to cry because he realizes.
Right. Yeah. So it's not that he wants her to stay at this point.
No, it's what he knows is supposed to
be. Her waking up, and he is now brokenhearted.
Yeah.
And he is inconsolable and crying. And what does he reveal?
That the witch has told him to be
a daughter of Eve,
yes.
Or a son of Eve.
There was a reason why he was so interested in her humanity, that he had been given a job, if you were to ever meet.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to ever, I think is the operative term here. Remember a couple of his books in the bookshelf? It was like, you know, man or myth? Does man really exist?
Yeah.
So, you know, he's never seen one before, and maybe he thinks he, you know, why would I, you know, it's a made-up creature. Man is make-believe. Man is, you know, like we think of unicorns, they think of men. Mm-hmm. They've never seen one, but just in case you do ever see one, what is he supposed to do?
He's supposed to capture it.
Bring it to the castle.
He is supposed to capture any human.
Any human.
And take it to
the witch.
The witch. All right, what do we know so far about the witch?
She's the
She keeps the world in the winter.
Okay. Narnia is under her thumb.
Yeah.
And she makes it always winter.
Yeah.
Always winter and never Christmas.
Never Christmas. And no Christmas is winter.
Now, to a child. That is one of the most evocative phrases that they would ever encounter. Yeah, nope. Now, being a Floridian, it's really hard for me to conceptualize a whole winter time. But I mean, I can play along. But the concept of always winter and never Christmas to a kid would hit them deep in the heart.
Yes.
Now,
especially a kid from the north.
Kid from the north, who it's cold, wet, and gray.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Moving up to Tennessee winter. For seminary, my wife and I were unprepared for the lack of sun.
The first snowfall.
And it was you know, it wasn't pretty. We had so little snow. We get a few days, but it was just months and months of cold, wet, and gray. You know, like upper 40s, lower 50s with a wetness in the air, and it was just awful. And just steel gray skies. And it just wore on you. And when the snow came, it was actually beautiful for a couple of days. Like, oh, this is great. But then it was just right back to sleep and slush and dirt.
But you had Christmas.
And Christmas, on the calendar, where does Christmas fall? December what? 25th. What is that very close to? Thinking seasonally.
Where?
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That the winter solstice, typically December 21st, December 22nd, what is noteworthy about the winter solstice?
Oh,
it is the longest night of the year. So the days and nights have been sort of switching positions, and there it's cold, and it's miserable, and it's dark. At the darkest the year gets, and right at that moment, the greatest and brightest of lights and joys. And it's like Christmas comes at just the right time. Now imagine always winter, never Christmas. That you know, it's bad now, but Christmas is coming and it'll be here. But now it's nothing but the bad. It's nothing but the cold, wet, and gray with no hope of anything good ever. Yeah. That's the oppressive sense of misery and really almost despair. I mean, how long could you go through that and kind of keep cheery about it?
Well, I think he was so sad that he couldn't stop crying. And she gave him her handkerchief. I love that scene. Where he was trying to take care of his tears and he brings the handkerchief.
He's not a bad person. Right.
Yeah. So initially, as he's explaining what's, you know, this sin in his life that is causing such grief, and Lucy's like, oh, you know, you're all, it's okay. There. Until what's kind of the final reveal here? He is not just someone who is in the employ of the White Witch to find and kidnap a human. He's doing it right now. I am kidnapping you. Dun, dun, dun. But, of course, his tears are expressing what?
He can't.
These are tears of repentance. These are tears of grief. He, now that he's actually met a daughter of Eve, now that he and Lucy are friends, you know, when they hit it off immediately, don't take this as just him play acting and he's nothing but conniving and sinister. I want to take this at face value. They seriously hit it off.
Yeah.
And now that push has come to shove, he cannot take her away fast asleep. He actually has to look her in the eye. He just can't do it. He just can't. Now, what is this going to mean for him?
Well, if the witch finds out, she's going to cut his horns off.
He could be in serious trouble. If anyone finds out...
The witch is going to cut his horns off.
might need to edit that part out. So it would be death. So he describes punishment, very very bad punishment. And, you know, he's physically harmed, and if she's in a very bad mood, what could she potentially do?
Turn into stone.
She has the magical power to turn the living into stone. And he is terrified of this, but even his fear is not enough for him to sacrifice Lucy. No. So he tries to get her back home.
To Ward.
to the shining town of Wardrobe. What is his fear even leading her back to the Wardrobe?
That someone will see.
Somebody might see them.
Yeah.
Now, I don't see anybody around. Who's going to see them?
Well, he said the trees were under.
Even some of the trees. Remember, this is a magical land.
Oh, yeah.
And there's stuff that's enchanted and alive that we never would have expected. But how ominous is that?
No.
You are now in a strange wood, and some of these trees are in the service of the evil witch.
Mm-hmm. Makes me think of the Wizard of Oz.
Ooh. So she makes it home. She finds, because she can see the doorway, she makes it through the firs. She bursts through the door and announces,
I'm back!
And so ends chapter 2. So, that's all we have for now. But based off of your reading of that, I am thinking that maybe we do 3, 4, and 5, so 3 chapters for next time. And I think that'll kind of take us to another kind of stopping point where it's kind of the adventure hits a point and then it goes in a different direction and in a different direction. So 3, 4, 5, that these chapters go quick. Okay. Anything else?
I think that I like that he found his courage because he talks about how his father would not have made the deal with the witch.
His father was a brave fawn. Right. And he sees himself as miserable and weak, maybe even unworthy. And maybe his dad is the fawn that there's a picture of with the gray beard or whatever. But maybe, just maybe, through this moment, he's going to be the sort of fawn that his dad was, and the sort of fawn that his dad would be proud of. And we have those moments sometimes, don't we? Where we could be the person we're afraid we might be, or we could become the person that we really ought to be.
Because he has a lot of self-loathing for some of his conversations.
For sure. For sure. And now, maybe that's going to change. There's been a moment of true courage, born through his own tears. We'll just have to see how that turns out for him.
Seems like she has a lot of honesty for him. So she has a lot of respect for him.
The honesty of a child.
Yeah.
She's kind.
Right. Yeah.
Well, she
but she's honest.
She's going to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
Yes. She believes he's going to do the right thing.
She does.
He doesn't.
Right.
She has faith in him when he doesn't have it in himself,
right.
And maybe that's enough to make the difference.
Mm-hmm.
That this child, whom I already love, they believe in me. Maybe I can do this after all.
Yeah.
That's good stuff?
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thank you, everybody. I love this book.